Good morning, it's me, John Royal, here in the hot seat. I'm joined now in the studio by Sussex psychologist Dr. Gillian Forrester. Her studies of gorillas at Portlaoise Wild Animal Park allegedly give us a clue as to how language developed in humans. Morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Now, I'll put you on that one, that's better than I can hear you. Where do we go from this? What on earth made you suddenly decide that was the thing you wanted to study?
From a very young age, I've always been really interested in how the brain works, why it works the way it does, and what makes us different from other animal species. And I don't know, we've all probably been through our teenage existentialist angst while we sit there and consider, why are we here? What's the purpose? And I think what I've realized over the years is that's not as interesting a question to me as to, how are we here? How did we acquire a brain that allows us to say, why are we here?
I was watching a programme, I think it was last night. I don't know if you've seen it, it's on BBC One, where they look in all scientific things. It's a bit like Blue Peter, but with scientists. Mm-hmm. And they were looking in a guy's brain and showing the wires that go and what does what and how on earth does it develop? I'm astounded by the way we've got where we are.
Yeah, it's astounding. Completely. Evolution is not it's not a simplistic thing, though. It hasn't happened in an orderly fashion. It's patchwork, and that's the way it's been all throughout. We've selected for things that have benefited our species throughout evolution and come up with this. And that's quite a fascinating thing to try to now look at it and work out how did we get here and why are we the way we are and why are we so different from other animals.
See, the thing which always gets me is they say if it was a clock of the world, 12-hour clock, mm-hmm. we've been here for the last second.
I think that analogy's used quite a lot.
And yet we've developed so far, haven't we?
We have. We have a huge history of developing, though, with our last common ancestor. So if you take back the evolutionary tree, we split from great apes about 5 or 6 million years ago. But prior to that, we shared all of our evolution with them. So we've had this last 6 million years to develop our own species in a different path from
but
all the other animals.
But they don't speak. We speak.
They don't speak. And that's the fascinating thing. So why do we speak, and what is it about our brains that are different from other animals?
So tell me, why do we speak, and why are our brains... You're the expert. That's what I've got you in here for.
Okay. Why do we speak? Well, obviously, we've evolved brains, sophisticated communication systems that have brought about language. But it didn't just pop out of nowhere. It wasn't miraculous. And we do have an evolutionary history. So my research really delves into working out what were the precursors to language. What were those abilities that we had that allowed us to evolve and develop language? And can we look back at our ancestors and see what those things were?
So what did going to Portlaoise do? How did you set about it?
The whole Portlaoise project has been to take lots and lots and lots of video of the gorillas' natural behaviors. And to look at all of their physical actions and all their kind of sensory perception, to code all of that up, which is an extremely time-consuming job, but to say, right, their right arm did this, and their eyes were looking that way, and their head was moving this way, and they were in the outdoor enclosure, and they were with this other person, and so forth. And to just collect an immense amount of data and then look for patterns in it. And to see, did they have sequences of actions that looked like they could be meaningful? Do they do specific sorts of gestures in the same context over time that maybe are meaningful? Because my idea is that if you just look at them and assume that they're going to have communication system that's somewhat similar to humans, that's a really kind of subjective way to view it. And maybe they don't. Maybe they, in the last 6 million years, have developed a slightly different communication system, and we should kind of look at them from the most objective perspective that we can.
See, I blame Walt Disney, because he, over the years, has made us think that animals are like humans, hasn't he? When you look at things...
By anthropomorphizing them.
Yes.
Yeah, very much so.
That was
so.
A very big word.
I know. So that projecting our human characteristics
yeah.
on animals. And yeah, we do that. But I think even as researchers, it's really hard to watch an ape behave and not say, oh, he's feeling this or she's doing that because it's very hard not to empathize and not to put ourselves in the shoes of the other individual. We do it with humans all the time.
So how did you separate the two then?
So the plan was to develop a method by which you're just coding the physical behaviors and not attribute my emotions to it. And that's a really, really difficult thing to do. But in my mind, that's the most scientifically objective way to approach the situation.
Who took the film? Did you actually go down and video them as well?
Yeah, I did with a research assistant, and we actually did two cameras at the same time. One that would be really close up on the individual that we were interested in, and another one that had a wide range. So,
you could actually view the two things at the same time?
View them together so you could see their social interactions, but you could also see their expressions and their limb movements and where they were within the environment. Because I think it's really important to understand not just a bit of communication in isolation, like, say you said something to me, hi, how are you? And we just took your audio and we listened to that. Well, that tells us something, but it doesn't tell us the whole story. You might have had a really aggressive look on your face at the time, or you might have been, you know, holding a hammer up in one hand. Who knows? But you can't tell the whole story yeah. by just one sensory channel. And this is kind of the approach that's been happening for research over the past decades, has been, let's just look at their vocalizations and see if we can work out their communication system. And I'm saying, well, actually, you can't do that. That's only a piece of the puzzle. Let's look at everything. And even though that's a magnificent job, it's huge and time-consuming, it's the right way to approach studying their communication systems.
Okay, we'll find out in just a moment how you got onto speech and how they speak to each other or don't. My guest in the studio today is Jill Forrester, Dr. Julian Forrester. She's a psychologist. She's been studying gorillas at Portland Wild Animal Park to give us a clue as how language developed in humans. Jill, what did you find then from... Because they don't speak, do they? What was the bit before we actually learnt to speak? There must be a point when...
Right, exactly.
When that grunting came to something. What did you decide?
Well, you've picked up on a really interesting point there with the grunting, because a lot of scientists thought, well, of course, it's going to be the vocalizations that are going to be the things that developed into language. And everybody looked at vocalizations, and nobody found a whole lot. And this research is an attempt to say, well, hang on a minute, it didn't have to be vocalizations. We do a lot of things visually. And people who don't learn to speak, they sign and use gestures. Couldn't it be that these animals were using some sort of gestures to communicate? And so that has been a huge line of research now, looking at their gestural communication. And it does appear that there's a far more sophisticated communication system for their hand gestures and their facial expressions than their vocalizations. And gorillas particularly, they're pretty quiet. They do a lot of kind of contented grunting and things like that, but they're not big kind of hooting and howling like the chimpanzees.
Because chimpanzees make hell of a row, don't they?
They do.
Especially down at Port Lim, I've noticed there.
They do, but the studies all show that those sorts of racket that they make are more like your crying and laughing noises, which aren't language ones, they're emotional ones. And they're ones that maybe you'd use for self-preservation, like you'd scream if you were being attacked, or you might yell if you found food, but they were all associated with things that were needed for survival and highly emotional things. Whereas communication seems to have come about more for social needs, like to socially network with your group and build relationships. And so actually, we think that it's been visual gestures that developed into language.
Yeah, because we do use visual gestures a lot. You beckon somebody over, you wave somebody goodbye, you wave them away, you do all sorts of things.
And we haven't even lost our visual gestures.
No.
So, you know, they're so strongly coupled to the way you speak. I mean, watch specifically, you know, even Italians are great at it, you know. They're very verbose and very, you know, emphasized visual gestures.
Facial gestures as well, you know, the smiling, the scowling, the we've still got all of them then.
We do.
So that is early speech as far as you're concerned.
It's part of early speech. I definitely think that communication language went through a phase of just being visual. Definitely before it moved to vocalization. We think it moved to vocalization because animals started using tools, and we needed those tools. We needed our hands to be free to manipulate things, so we needed another form of communication. And plus, visual signals, while they're really great, you can't see them in the dark, and you can't see them over long distances, and vocalizations were a benefit at that stage.
So how did the vocalization start? Have you actually got to that point yet?
That's a huge controversy in the field, and nobody really knows when or how the switch was made. But there was a pressure to switch because the hands were busy.
This is much the same as crawling on all fours and suddenly standing up, isn't it? That was almost like a switch going, wasn't it?
Well, again, that was allowed the hands to be free. And that allowed us to, you know, walk bipedally and use our hands to do different things.
And wave at people.
And wave at people. The bipedal came long before the language in the
community. But it was a switch, wasn't it?
Definitely, yeah, selective pressure to be bipedal, because it gave us some benefits.
Yeah, you've gained an extra 3 foot for sure.
Sure.
Yeah. And then, but have you actually found out then where speech came from?
Okay, so the theory I'm working on
here we go. Scientists, you see, I've got this thing about scientists. They told us for centuries that the Earth was flat, and all of a sudden they told us it was round, and we have to believe them.
Yeah, and have you proven them wrong yet? You haven't fallen off,
no.
So all's well. Okay, so language, if you stop thinking about it as this massively complicated thing, just look at it for what it is. It's a set of rules. It's a set of rules that you use in a sequence. And to look at the evolution of it, we've got to look for something else that we did long, long time ago that had a set of rules in a sequence. And my theory is that this was tool use. Because to make and use tools, you had to be able to know what the goal was, complete a set of rules in a particular order to actually get to the correct goal state. And by doing this, you're actually creating a really simple syntax. And a syntax is what you need to develop a language. So I'm not the only one who has this theory, but I'm the first one to actually collect data on it. So some people have said that this is a possibility, but it's always been a theoretical possibility. And now we're saying, come on now, let's actually look at the behaviors. Is this for real? And you know, is it true? And so far what we're finding is, yeah, this all fits really nicely. Tool users are developing a simple syntax.
But how?
How are they developing the simple syntax? Well, clearly,
you've got to explain this on the radio. It's all right writing it down and that in some sort of thesis, but I actually want to know how it went from somebody using a tool or making a tool to actually make a noise to go with making the tool.
Okay, but let's forget about the noise, because it probably would have stayed with the visual, with the hand movement.
Yeah, but the noise has got to come somewhere.
At some point the noise came, but that's after you'd already developed a communication system, and then it could make a switch to vocalization. So you develop a syntax first.
Yeah.
And that's the tool use. And then you realize, okay, hey, this bit of my brain has developed the capability to do structured sequences. So we know which bit of the brain that is for language. It's this bit called Broca's area, and it's kind of right over your ear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bigger on the left side of your brain. And we've now scanned the brains of apes and humans when they're using tools, and we're lighting up the same area. So we have a really good idea now that those two different tasks, language and tool use, occupy the same bit of the brain.
Right. The thing which is confusing, well, not confusing me here, but making me wonder, is when we are thinking, we think in words.
Yes.
Now, the gorillas don't have words. How do gorillas think?
Oh, gosh. If I could answer that question,
because that's where the language
problems.
Comes from, isn't it? It's those words that you think we actually put out as a sound.
So this is a really good question, and I'm going to refer to this book that I've just been reading to my daughter called I Was a Rat by Philip Pullman. And it's about a young boy. Well, he looks physically like a young boy, but he acts like a rat. And people keep asking him, well, what was it like when you were a rat? And he said, well, I just was. And now that I'm a boy, now I think that I am, rather than just being. And this is a huge question. What was cognition like before language in humans, and did we have consciousness? And some scientists will even go as far to say, well, if you don't have language, you don't have consciousness, therefore dogs and cats and all of those animals that we kind of assume have their own thoughts and feelings and emotions, well, actually, they're not conscious ones.
But they have something, don't they?
Well, they have something, and I think it's a bit...
Unless we're humanizing them again.
Well, yeah, okay, but here, then what about this question? What about infants who haven't acquired language yet? We attribute consciousness to them, but is that fair? They don't have language.
Yeah, how does a baby think?
Oh, exactly. A really good question, and we haven't been able to answer these questions yet.
Because I can't remember.
So I'm being an objective scientist. I would say if apes don't have language and we're not going to attribute consciousness to them, then we cannot attribute consciousness to babies, even though we know that they will develop language.
Yeah, because I can remember laying in my pram when I must have only been 10, 11, 12 months old and seeing my grandfather working, chopping up wood. Now, so I had a consciousness there, but I couldn't speak at that age.
So you remember prior prior to speaking. That's quite young. Most people don't remember back
that far.
It's only
one little bit.
So these maybe are snapshots, and maybe you have a series of visual images.
Yeah.
But it is language that allows us to share our histories and our experiences, which allows you then to build memories. And Barbara King calls it the dynamic dance, that your consciousness and your ability to understand the world and understand what other people think and what you think and reflect on their thoughts and your thoughts is this continuous dynamic interaction with other people. But prior to that, when you don't have language, it's all just within your own head.
I could talk to you for hours on this, but I can't because we've run out of time. But thank you very much for coming in. I just point out that you are actually British, aren't you? Even though you've got an American accent.
I am, yeah.
You spent your formative years in...
Well, born in New York, raised in California, but been in Oxford, London, and Brighton now. So.
And you're British anyway.
I'm British by citizenship, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming in. You haven't got a book out or anything, have you? You're not.
Oh, hopefully. A chapter coming out soon, a couple papers.
All right. Yeah, we don't read papers.
Oh,
we only
I know.
Want to read paperback books, don't we? Thank you very much for joining us this
it's
morning,
been a pleasure.
Jill. And we'll talk to you again sometime.
Okay.
It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Dr. Gillian Foster, who's a Sussex psychologist, she lives down there. You're at University of Westminster, aren't you?
That's right, yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for joining us this morning.